is for the company.
What we look at is whether your security measures were in place. If actually you're found to have fallen short, then you do face your potential action and a penalty from the Information Commissioner. You know, we can impose fines of up to £500,000.
A man and his wife have been jailed for 7 years between them for glorifying the murder of Fusilier Lee Rigby in YouTube videos. Royal Barnes was seen describing the soldier's killing as a brilliant day and laughing as he drove past floral tributes. There's been a damning assessment of how the cooperative group is run. Former City Minister Lord Miners says the organisation will go bust without major change. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
On BCFM every Sunday.
At 4pm we join the Somali show, followed at 5 by the Voice of Sudan.
مستمعي الكرام مرحبا بكم نعود مره اخرى لصوت السودان وهذه هي الساعه الثانيه. Welcome listener to Voice of Sudan.
At 7 it's contemporary Christian music with Danny Lopez.
Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated? With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappears on the way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. It's now becoming pretty clear that rather than just crashing, the plane deliberately broke contact in some way with the outside world. Boeing 777 turned west, changed course and altitude, then, according to Rolls-Royce, landed, possibly 2,200 miles away. So why all the disinformation and contradictions from Malaysian military and government? Why won't the authorities be honest with those hundreds of families who've lost their loved ones? Not like us with the EU referendum. Putin's not messing around with Crimea. It'll be all over by Monday. Referendum's on Sunday. We'll be talking to Marina Morris, who's just back from eastern Ukraine, and Martin Summers in a minute. And barrister Michael Shrimpton, who accused the former Prime Minister Ted Heath of being a paedophile, and worse even. He's in court in London this week. This time he's representing himself, and he's in the dock. He's being prosecuted for a nuclear bomb hoax at the London Olympics. And David Powell's here from Friends of the Earth to talk about nuclear, to talk about fracking, and also why the badger coal has cost us £30,000 per badger. Part 3 of Paul Mason's series that he thinks can't be made in Britain today, the People's First World War. Part 3 this week, the revolutions. But we start this week by having a chat to Nicholas Dunbar. Now, Nicholas is the author of a book came out in 2011 called The Devil's Derivatives, and he's joining me on the line now. Hi, Nick, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi.
First of all, just to give us an idea of your journalistic background, Nick.
So I've been a financial journalist since 1997, and I focused on a very specialised corner of journalism. I focused on the sort of complex side of financial markets, basically, because I had a science background. And yeah, this was a very obscure area for many years, and until it blew up really in the financial crisis in 2008. And ever since then, the derivatives and risk management have been in the headlines. So that's kind of really where I come from.
Great title, The Devil's Derivatives. But what is a derivative?
Well, very simply, it's a financial contract that's derived, hence the name, from something else. So It can be the interest rate on a loan between a pair of banks, or it can be the price of a share or an exchange rate or a commodity price. Anything really that's financial can be turned into derivatives.
And why do the financial sector so like these things? And what do they do with them, and how do they make money out of them?
What I argue in my book is that really that they've ended up sort of taking over finance. So, you know, something that ended, started out being a kind of a the tail on the back of the sort of the giant elephant of the market, so it became the tail that wagged the beast itself. They're popular because they allow institutions, customers of banks to transform one risk into another, and then the banks like them because they can sell a lot of them without adding to the exposure on their balance sheet, or at least accounting rules tend to hide those risks, which make derivatives incredibly important. And what they do is they lock in these derivatives with a customer on one side and a customer on the other, and then they make a profit out of that. And then they find new customers that aren't familiar with these contracts, and they persuade them to buy them. So that's now become a multi-trillion dollar industry.
Now, was there ever a sort of attempt to introduce derivatives so it was knocked back, or was this something that all the regulators, even though they're now really quite well known to be rather weak, if really doing very much at all, was there an attempt to bring derivatives in that was knocked back, or was this just simply dreamt up and then immediately allowed by these big financial institutions?
Well, the background to this is that for many years, financial markets, particularly derivatives, were virtually unregulated. It was not like the stock exchange, where there's an awful lot of attention placed on what companies report to the stock market, what they say, what they announce, and things like that. There's always been a lot of focus on merger acquisitions, those kind of things. But derivatives have always been in the background. They've been the big part of them have been privately negotiated contracts between customers. And the regulators thought, well, this is growing very fast. It's bringing a lot of revenue to the City of London. Let's not step in the way. So that was the context. I think what happened was that originally they were invented to service large institutions like IBM or BAE Systems back in the 1980s. And then as the banks ran out of those big customers, they wanted to find smaller ones. So they started to sell these derivatives to fish and chip shops and old people's homes and housing associations. And we've seen a lot of problems as interest rates fell in the last few years, where people have realised that they shouldn't have been buying these things.
Well, that's fascinating that you're saying that's BAE Systems and IBM. I mean, these are sort of military industrial complex style firms. What were they originally actually doing with these? What kinds of contracts were they buying? What were they buying into? And what were they, how was that helping these businesses?
Well, I mean, a good example would be, say, an airline like British Airways. If you invest in British Airways, you're probably going to be expecting to be buffeted by the swings in the oil price. That's their biggest cost to fly a plane. And so what they do is they buy commodity derivatives that smooth out or reduce the volatility of the oil price, and they try to smooth that uncertainty out, and that's supposed to be good for their shareholders. So, these companies use derivatives in that kind of way, but they're supposedly quite sophisticated in the way they do it.
I think there's very little real understanding amongst many people, and this may be deliberate, about the way the city really works. I mean, particularly with the big four accounting firms getting things so very, very wrong in the run-up to 2008. I mean, basically signing off balance sheets that were junk, virtually. So what are your thoughts about the state of regulation? I mean, we've got the FSA has now become, let's start with them, they've now become the Financial Conduct Authority. Do you think that's there's going to be any real difference with the FCA rather than the previous FSA?
Well, so what happened was the FSA, the Financial Services Authority, was split into two in 2010. So it was split into a part that regulated banks and insurance companies, which is now called the Prudential Regulatory Authority, and then the other bit which regulates the conduct of in financial markets, that's called the FCA. So the problem with the FSA was that they didn't want to be too hard on the banks, because if you crack down on them too much, then they might go bust. that's a, you know, putting it very crudely, if you come down on them aggressively, then that's going to reduce confidence in those institutions. And in 2008, it was a real worry about these big banks like RBS actually going bust. So there was a conflict of interest in the old system, and the idea now is that you can separate it out. You know, one regulator is just trying to keep the banks solvent, and the other one is cracking down on things like market abuse. And so it's an improvement in a way, but as we're seeing from the criticism that the regulators have been under over problems like mis-selling and market rigging, they've still got a long way to go.
One of the accusations is that a lot of financial journalists are just too close to the city, and that their interests are really lie with the city, not with the public that are reading their articles. What are your thoughts on that one?
I think it's something that it crosses financial journalists' mind. I think the test really is how angry they make people with their stories. How upset are the powers that be when you try to publish something? I think all I can do is speak for myself that when I publish stories about things like the Greek government buying derivatives from Goldman Sachs, I did get threatening lawyers' letters, so I can feel that I think I've tweaked a few institutions that didn't like being tweaked.
Well, that sounds good anyway. I mean, The Devil's Derivatives is the title of the book. Why the devil? Where is the devil in all this?
Well, the reason I use that title was I think that old-fashioned finance, where banks made loans, on the one side, they did things like issue shares and advise on takeovers on the other side, that became completely overwhelmed with this world of derivatives, where you no longer knew what a bank was doing. Where you think that there's a high street bank like RBS that's supposedly just innocently making loans and taking your money in its savings accounts, but in fact what they turned into is this giant derivatives machine, where it was much more important for them to rig the market on one side, and there's investigations going on that, rather than do a good service to their customers. So the drive to make profits in derivatives corrupted the institutions. It led them to put themselves first in a way that was very bad for a lot of their customers, and is still being worked out by regulators.
Yes, not the only time when selfishness has come in with these big financial institutions. What are your thoughts on the influence of the City of London on politics and on our political parties? Because it doesn't seem to be a lot of action. I mean, we've had Andrew Tyrie and his committee saying we've got to separate casino banking from high street banking. And, of course, that can also, again, has been kicked down the road, even though this was supposed to happen straight away.
Well, I think the trouble has always been that the City of London has contributes an exaggerated part of UK GDP, so it's seen as a bit of a golden goose that you don't want to damage it, because you're going to damage the entire economy. The bankers, the people that are connected to the City of London, the lawyers, the advisors, all the people that work there, they pay a lot of taxes, and their bonuses, they contribute to taxes, and all of that is something that the government doesn't want to risk when it's trying to get out of recession.
Also, I noticed you've done another book too, haven't you? It's in the title of it. It says The Secret Trillion Dollar Machine. What is this secret trillion dollar machine? This is, again, what you're painting a picture here of lots of stuff going on behind the scenes, out of the view of the public, which we simply are not being told about. We do not understand, and they don't want us to understand.
Well, I think yes, you might be referring to my first book, which was called Inventing Money. That was about a big hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management that collapsed in 1998, and that's it's essentially my mission really to writing these books has been to try to explain to people how important this stuff is, and it's if people don't know about it, then they're not going to be able to do anything about it.
Okay, inventing money, is that what they were really doing? I mean, you know, you do get this impression sometimes that when these big banks are fined, you know, Barclays or RBS or whatever get a fine, and somebody goes into a room in somewhere up in the heights of the bank, gets on a computer terminal, gets onto an account, presses a few zeros and invents a bit of money to pay the fine. And of course, that isn't necessarily going to be much of a disincentive for other banks to do the same thing the person is. But I mean, are these hedge funds and banks actually really able to invent money like that?
Well, in a sense, derivatives made that possible, because what they'd do is that they'd create structured products. They'd get these whiz kids with PhDs, mathematicians, you know, the best computers. They'd construct these things that you know, seem to lock in these profits at very low risk, that they could put lots of them on their balance sheets, and they would make, you know, great profits from them. As you said earlier, the accountants were kind of not really paying attention. They didn't understand what these things were. So yes, it seemed like a money machine, kind of a way of just generating free money and fantastic bonuses, Porsches, you know, big houses for the lucky few that were in this world.
Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about the influence of derivatives in creating the crash, first of all, back in 2008, and also the potential now, because not a lot has changed since then, really, for another crash?
Well, in many ways, the situation's worse than it was before the crash in 2008. The derivatives bubble is bigger. I don't suppose Nicholas would disagree with that.
Can we just ask you, Nicholas, what are your thoughts on that one?
No, Martin's right. The size of the derivative market has, on the whole, has grown since the crisis. I mean, a few sectors of the market have shrunk, but for the most part, it continues to grow.
And is it mostly the quantitative easing money that's going into this, or I mean, is it a real kind of investment in a real world, or is this just a casino?
Well, it's often sold as a kind of a safety measure, a protective measure. You have you know, people that are worried about jumps in interest rates, so a bank will say, you know, here's a product that will protect you against them, against that happening. Of course, they go the other way, and then the customer loses money. So a lot of the times, people think they're getting something that makes their life safer, reduces their risk, but it turns out to be a bet that they didn't really understand they were getting into.
Yeah, well, I mean, the derivatives market, in a way, has replaced traditional insurance, isn't it? I mean, people used to insure their, you know, their companies or whatever against various things that might happen. But insurance was a very heavily regulated industry. I mean, you know, organisations like Lloyd's insurers had to have the wherewithal to pay out if there was a tsunami or whatever. Derivatives they give the illusion of being insured when you buy a derivatives contract. But in actual fact, there's not necessarily any counterparties to the contract when it comes to the crunch. I mean, you mentioned long-term capital management there and the collapse of that in 1998. I mean, that was created by Myron Scholes and his chums. The Black-Scholes theorem was underpinning it. There was a sort of revolution, supposedly intellectual revolution in economics, underpinning all of this. They got the Nobel Prize for economics. They set up long-term capital management. And then, of course, what happened in 1998 was that the Russian government refused to pay what they owed to the international markets. And they're not Bangladesh. They've got nuclear weapons, and they just said, we're not paying. And suddenly the Black-Scholes theorem, which underpinned long-term capital management, was just proved to be nonsense. So you've got two aspects to this. One is the intellectual indefensibility of derivatives. I mean, Benjamin Mandelbrot, the mathematician, even wrote a book about this, pointing out that chaos theory actually undermines derivatives, which are all based on traditional mathematics. And then the other thing is the vested interests involved in all of this. It shovels money in the direction of the already wealthy. And then, of course, the state steps in and bails it out. In 1998, long-term capital management was the canary in the mine. So one hedge fund made silly bets on Russia, and the whole financial system is potentially going down the drain until the US government steps in and bails it out. That was the canary in the mine, and we've been carrying on building this derivatives bubble ever since then. And to be honest with you, I can't see any way out of this apart from a massive meltdown and a crash. I mean, Warren Buffett, the world's richest man, has called derivatives weapons of financial mass destruction, and I don't think he's wrong.
I would agree that's a good phrase. I mean, at this moment, what we've got is these emergency easing measures by central banks. The you know, quantitative easing that the Bank of England, the Fed, and others have been implementing, and I think a lot of people are worried about what happens as they reduce that, and they sort of take the foot off the pedal there. And the derivatives could well be a mechanism for to transmit these risks around the market. We're starting to see that with emerging market countries. They've been having a bit of a tough time in the last few months. And what we've seen in the past is that derivative markets are a hidden way of contagion spreading through the financial system.
Nick, I have to ask you before we say goodbye, what are your thoughts about solutions to this? Everyone knows that it's a mess. There's a lot of vested interest trying to tell us everything's fine when we know it's not. How do we fix it?
Well, I think we have to have a much stricter way of looking at the relationship between banks and their customers, particularly when they're smaller or less sophisticated institutions. I think there's been massive overreach by the banks in going to the high street, going to the smaller, less sophisticated customers, and I think it's been very slow, the realisation that was just out of line and has to be stopped. I think there's still a lot of progress to be done in terms of really restricting what banks do with their customers, and ensure that if they that there's bad conduct or misconduct in this area, that the bankers actually pay a price for it.
You mean jail?
Well, we've got this issue of, you know, it's called mis-selling or something like that, but the idea of criminal penalties in banking is a very recent invention. I mean, until recently, no one would ever accuse a banker of any of a crime in this kind of context. It was they were considered to be just a slap on the wrist, or maybe a fine at worst.
So do you think jailing is necessary? I mean, that's what they've done in Iceland, isn't it, for example?
I think that there's good reason to make bankers a little bit more scared about doing these things in the future. I mean, the kind of abuses that have taken place in the last few years, one wonders if it would have been as bad if there had been a little bit more fear of the consequences. I don't think that fear was there at all.
Okay, Nicholas Dunbar, author of the 2011 book The Devil's Derivatives, who one of the best covers I've seen, with a sort of a financial graph that goes up and then down with a bomb hanging off the end of it. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show this evening.
Thank you, Danny.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, it's all happening on Sunday with the crisis in Ukraine and with Vladimir Putin, and the Russians have organised a very quick referendum in Crimea to see if the local people in Crimea, who live, which is a region of, was anyway, a region of the Ukraine, want to actually join with the Russian Federation and therefore, of course, keep the Russian Black Sea Fleet in operation. But I'm joined now by Marina Morris, who just last week came back from Kharkov, her home city in the east of Ukraine. So, Marina, you have a report for us now, I think.
Yes, hello. 16th of March, Crimea referendum. The legal procedure. There is no legal foundation and legal status for a local Crimean referendum. This $1.8 million cost. The decision to hold it violates at least 8 articles of the Constitution of Ukraine and 4 articles of the Constitution of Crimea. There is no world examples of properly preparing referendum in 10 days. A free referendum needs debate, discussion, informing the population and time. There are no commissions established to count the votes. Whoever counts them will also write the result. 2.2 million ballot paper have been printed for the referendum, 400,000 more than the total population of Crimea of 1.8 million, including not voting people such as children. There have been no debate or agreements of the question asked. The Ukrainian government, United Nations expert, and European Union observers have not even been allowed to observe it, and military presence of 1,000 foreign troops in Crimea. The real situation in Crimea. The Crimea is occupied by Russian military. They have created pro-Russian local authorities and replaced state power. This creates tremendous economic chaos and psychological tension in the peninsula and country. The beautiful spring Crimean streets are full of these people in uniform with guns and weapons. President Putin denies this and told Paralympic delegates in the Black Sea port of Sochi Russia was not the initiator of these circumstances. According to the 2010 Kharkov Agreement about Russian Navy presence in Sevastopol, Russia can have military planes, ships, and troops on agreed basis. But now Russia operates outside these agreed bases and has taken control of key facilities such as airport. From the airport of Crimea capital Simferopol, you can only get to Moscow. The train station is running in its usual schedule, but people in uniform have seized and now control the Crimea Transport Administration. In Crimea, Ukrainian TV channels are switched off. Only Russian TV channels are transmitting. And recently, Russia created more tension by starting military exercise involving 8,000 more troops close to the border with Ukraine. 2 days ago, the leader of the Crimean Tatars met President Putin in Moscow and said the Crimean Tatars will boycott the 16th of March referendum with its predetermined result. Tatars cannot see their future as a part of Russia. Are Crimean Tatars, it's 12% of the population of Crimea. Newly released February poll conducted both in Ukraine and Russia before pro-Russian troops seized control in Crimea. And this poll reveals 41% of the Crimean population wanted to rejoin to Russia, 33% in Donetsk, and 15% in Kharkov want to rejoin Russia. Ukraine and the free world will never accept the result of this referendum, which has no moral or legal effect, and would violate the United Nations Charter and 4 other international agreements. From Brussels, the Crimean referendum is a threat throughout the European Union. The European Union is ready to make economic sacrifices and take sanctions against Russia and proposed 11 billion euro in financial aid to Ukraine. The leader of G7 group and European Union threatened to take further actions individually and collectively if Russia continues off its course. President Obama met Ukraine Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk and supported him. Congress voted $1 billion of loan guarantees to Ukraine. China still seems to be siding with Russia, advising the European Union not to impose sanctions. Ukraine and the world will never accept the annexation of sovereign Ukrainian territory. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the territory integrity of Ukraine cannot be called into question. If Russia continues on its course of the past weeks, it will not only be a catastrophe for Ukraine. Former Soviet Union President Gorbachev, 82, who has Russian and Ukrainian heritage and whose reforms helped end the Cold War but led to the Soviet Union demise, appealed to both presidents, Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama, to help Ukraine resolve this conflict peacefully and prevent a new Cold War. Russian clearly and unambiguously recognized Ukraine and its modern border. It was in Almaty Declaration of December 1991, after which the Soviet Union was history. In 1994, Budapest Memorandum, when Russia, United States, and UK offered Ukraine security guarantees in exchange for abandoning the third largest stock of nuclear weapons, an agreement to host the Black Sea Fleet in the Crimea port in 1997. It is absolutely unacceptable to have Russian boots on Ukrainian grounds in the 21st century, violating all international deals and treaties, said the Ukraine Prime Minister. The Ukrainian government wants peace, stability, and is sensitive towards the main fears of the Kremlin. The government will not consider membership of NATO. There are lots of new initiatives towards the status of the Russian language and all rights of Russian speakers in Crimea, more autonomy for the Crimea region. Many Russian people support Putin's actions, but many others feel shame towards aggression. The main loser is Putin, and in the long run, Putin's occupation demonstrates his weakness. He is exploiting, not helping, the political and economical crisis left by Yanukovych regime. War, blood, tears, and instability is the worst choice and the shameful scenario for the leader of the great nation. What would my grandfather, a Russian World War II pilot, said, who will defend the Crimea in 1942. I spoke to horrified veterans who also fight against Nazi intervention in Crimea and Sevastopol, and now to see Russian aggression on Ukraine soil. President Putin, you can do another choice. Show your humanity. Feel our pain. Stand back and take your troops home.
Well, I don't think he's likely to do that, Marina, but you're quite within your rights to appeal to him. Martin, this referendum that's happening on Sunday, what is going to happen? Is it almost certainly the population, which is mainly Russian-speaking, is going to vote for to stay with the Russians rather than to be part of Ukraine? Marina's talking there about all the illegality of it. But essentially, I mean, you've got a situation where, I mean, for example, in Crimea, if there was an area of Crimea which was maybe one tenth of Crimea which was Tatars, should they be able to secede from Crimea like Crimea wants to secede from Ukraine?
Well, that is the big question. I think that probably they will win this referendum for going with the Russian Federation. But the Crimean Tatars, who are the original inhabitants, and as Marina said, are 12 or 13% of the population, they're not very happy about that at all. And of course, they might decide, and people may decide to try and reverse this referendum result through force. We saw a very similar situation in Slovenia in 1991, where a pro-Western government came to power in Slovenia and declared its independence completely against the constitution of then Yugoslavia. The Yugoslav National Army moved into Slovenia, not in actual fact to repress the Slovenians, but in actual fact to control the border with the West, and they were fired upon by the Slovenian National Guard, thus precipitating all of the wars of succession in former Yugoslavia. And in my book, written in 1998 with Laszlo Andor, who's now a European Commissioner for Jobs and Growth in Brussels, I predicted exactly this kind of scenario for Ukraine, very similar to Yugoslavia. Because once you get people start declaring independence, then that's a slippery slope potentially to violence. Now, I think the way this will play out is that they will have their referendum. They will it will pass by some kind of majority, but maybe 40% will vote against. So it's a very questionable whether that's that you can build a state on that basis. But then the Crimean Tatars and the government in Ukraine may decide to fight. Now, don't forget, the government in Ukraine came to power not through an election, but through fighting its way in from the street. And Marina talked earlier about the role of the Ukrainians in the Second World War. The Crimean Tatars, of course, were at the when Crimea was recaptured by the Soviet forces, the whole population was deported to Siberia and suffered terribly during that era because they were accused of collaboration with the Nazis. But of course, in the Ukrainian regime in Kiev, people running the army, the police, and all the security services are, in fact, the Nazi Ukrainians who allied in that era with the German far right. Now, and they are now in power.
Marina mentioned the former president of the Soviet Union, one of the last ones, Mikhail Gorbachev. He's saying today on his blog, apparently, that he holds the original cause of the current dire situation in Ukraine and Crimea is in the deliberate wrecking of perestroika and the thoughtless and adventurous dissolving of the Soviet Union. He says he was fighting to keep the union state by all political means he had at his disposal, and he'd like to emphasise these were political means.
Well, I think Gorbachev is actually quite a helpful intervention, because what he's saying, whatever the difficulties and differences there are, and there are difficulties and differences, and we've seen similar problems inside our own country in Northern Ireland, for example, there is no reason for people to settle political differences with violence. We can all disagree about things. I mean, perhaps we'll be disagreeing about the exact status of Crimea for many years to come. Kosovo, for example, has not been recognised by Spain because they don't want to recognise breakaways in Yugoslavia, because the Catalans will want independence inside Spain. But Britain and the West did recognise Kosovo, even though they had a strong Serbian minority who didn't want to be independent of Serbia.
Well, we've been hearing, but there we go, for example, about lots of militias in the streets in not identifiable necessarily as Russian troops over in Crimea. But there's also been film of, and in fact the Daily Mail published an article just last weekend saying, has Blackwater been deployed to Ukraine? Notorious US mercenaries apparently seen on the streets of a flashpoint city as Russia in Ukraine, as Russia claims 300 hired guns have arrived in the country. So is it feasible that that the Blackwater involved these kind of private mercenaries?
Listen, the situation is very confused, and we can make all sorts of assertions, but it is a fact that the Estonian foreign minister, in a private phone call to Catherine Ashton, the head of the EU, was saying that he believed, having spoken to doctors, that the snipers that carried out the assassinations of both police officers and protesters in the Maidan Square were actually working with the Pravi sector right wing, and UNO, Ukrainian paramilitary organisation, has got very strong links with NATO going back to the 90s, and they, for example, they've been deployed inside Chechnya fighting with Chechen rebels. And this is all, I'm not saying that this is true, I'm just saying that's what we've been told. So the situation is very confused. It's not clear that the government in Kiev is a constitutional government, and at that point it becomes very difficult to argue about the constitutional government.
Monday is a big day when the result of the referendum in Crimea is announced, and also the Americans, NATO, are basically saying that there could be massive economic sanctions on Monday if they vote the wrong way. So what are your thoughts about whether that will be imposed?
I think that won't happen, because the Russians and the Chinese are in a position, if they wish, to crash the US economy, and they may decide, if we're going to have to fight with the Americans, we might as well fight now as later. That's the danger.
BCFM 93.2 Bristol is our community.
Well, Michael Shrimpton, he's a lawyer and a barrister who has accused the former Prime Minister Ted Heath of being a paedophile. He's in court next week, and I spoke to him earlier this week about the case that he's putting together. He's being prosecuted for a nuclear bomb hoax at the London Olympics.
I am going on trial at Southwark Crown Court, Court 1, on Monday, accused of making a bomb hoax arising out of a nuclear security threat to the London Olympic Games.
Okay, well, would you like to tell us how the ball started rolling on this?
I returned to England in April 2012, having written my book Spy Hunter, which is being published next month. And I was in the process of resetting up, both as a barrister and setting up a new home in England. And intelligence was passed to me by a man named Jones, who was one of my sources, a very reliable source over many years. And Mr. Jones passed intelligence, which had been supplied to him from other sources, including a source in Tokyo named Sorge, and this is all going to come out in open court next week. It is all in my defence case statement. It's all on the record. And the intelligence was to the effect that a nuclear device had been inserted into England and was actually present at that point in London, which I regarded with some degree of seriousness. And having consulted with a friend of mine, an air marshal called Sir John Walker, former deputy chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee and former director general of intelligence, acting on his advice, very sensible advice, completely agree with it, I contacted the new National Security Council and went through to the Minister of the Secretary of State for Defence's office in the House of Commons.
Michael, this is no ordinary bomb hoax. This is a nuclear bomb hoax, allegedly. Don't you think that there's a little bit of a problem here right from the fundamentals, that if one believes there may be a bomb somewhere, actually it is your duty to report it?
Well, indeed, and one of the defence arguments will be that since the intelligence suggested that the device was going to be set off for the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, and since Her Majesty the Queen was going to be present, and since that was would be an act of treason under a common law offence known as misprision of treason, or common law principle, any of the lieges are under duty to report any threat to the life of the sovereign. What the jury will be told is that the citizens are under, subjects are of the Queen are under duty to report any threat to her life. The defence case is, well, I believe there was a threat. The intelligence was, in my view, credible and needed to be investigated, and it was passed on to the Secretary.
But the whole thing ended up with a raid on your home where your manuscript for your book Spy Hunter was taken. Tell us a little bit about this book, because this is another interesting side to it, Michael, to have this book coming out what was probably going to be during the trial. Tell us about that book.
Yes, the book I had written, Spy Hunter, I stood down to write this in 2010. I went abroad to write Spy Hunter. It was safer to write it abroad, apart from anything else, and it was also more convenient. And I, the book is a history of German intelligence, and in particular, it's a history of covert German intelligence after 1945, and the covert German service that was set up in 44 to take over from the Abwehr and military intelligence in the event of German defeat, and also the Gestapo, called the Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst.
Fascinating. And the other thing, of course, is there is quite a lot on the record about that. For example, Reinhard Gehlen, who was in charge of the German intelligence during the war on the Eastern Front, was basically taken up by the Americans and the British and then installed in a very similar job not long after the war.
Correct, and indeed the Bundesnachrichtendienst, which is the German, the on-the-record white German intelligence service, was originally known as the Gehlen Organisation. What I reveal in my book, which has not so far been revealed in public, is that Gehlen was DVD, and that Gehlen was not working for the Americans, he was working for the Germans. And he was installed by a man named Alan Welsh Dulles, a German spy, working with his brother, John Foster Dulles, another German spy, who in the war were based in Bern, Switzerland, and at one point had tried to negotiate a separate peace in 1943.
So do you think that it's fair to say that that there has been some kind of almost like Fourth Reich carrying on behind the scenes since the end of the Second World War?
Well, correct. I mean, technically, the Federal Republic of Germany is the Fourth Reich. What the book says, in terms, is that German intelligence was not shut down in 1945, and if you think about it, it makes sense. Why were the Germans, who are known to have an extensive overseas network in London, Washington, Moscow and elsewhere, why would they shut down their intelligence? Nobody shuts down their intelligence networks. They're too valuable. Obviously, the German intelligence services were reorganized. Admiral Canaris survived World War II. Now, one of the witnesses next week, and I'm not going beyond what the jury will be hearing, but the jury will be hearing from a witness who met and dealt with Admiral Canaris after he was officially dead, and who visited his gravesite, and that will be one of the issues. And Admiral Canaris is a man with two graves, and normally when you deal with intelligence chiefs with two graves, that's usually a clue that at some point they have faked their death.
Well, one of the things we know also is that the Nazis looted a tremendous amount of wealth from Europe as they took it over in the middle of World War II. Whatever happened to that loot?
Most of it went into Switzerland, some of it went down to Argentina. It is a theme of Spy Hunter. And not all the German gold was originally German. Some of it had come in from the Far East in order to bankroll the Third Reich. Some of it had come out of China, and various people had a hold on it. Most of the German gold went into Kloten in Switzerland. There's a very large gold depository under Zurich Airport, which has been there for decades. So large it has a little electric train. You go around it, you know, it's a little narrow-gauge railway. Now, some of the gold went down to Argentina. A number of very powerful bank accounts were set up. One, which the jury will be hearing about, was for a company called SBC Charcoal Limited, or SBC Charcoal SA. Now, that's the single most important offshore company in European history. It's the master European Union slush fund, and when I last saw a tear-off sheet for SBC Charcoal's account, it had $100 billion in it, or a little bit over. I think it was $101,693,000,000.
Now, what will you say to people that say, Michael, this is just too incredible? Surely somebody would have told us about this in the 60 years since the end of the war.
Well, somebody did. My friend Christopher Story did go public on the DVD in 2005, but he wasn't believed and was then assassinated for his pains by a German agent in Erie, Pennsylvania. It's another thing that was coming out during the course of the trial. Christopher, I'm not the first to go public on the DVD. Christopher went public in 2005, and he was murdered in 2010. He was murdered by induced liver cancer, being one, the weaponization of cancer being one of the German priorities during World War II, one of the reasons why so many people died such terrible deaths in Dachau concentration
camp. Well, we're not talking about just that. I mean, Hugo Chavez, for the president of Venezuela, many others in South America have died of cancer, haven't they?
Yes.
Tell us about your book again, anyway, Michael, finally. Where and when will it be available? How can people get hold of it when it comes out?
The full title of the book is Spy Hunter, the Secret History of German Intelligence. It's been published by June Press, very nice people. They're based in Totnes in Devon. Cover price of £25, and we anticipate publication in the second week of April.
Without wishing to prejudice justice at all, I do wish you justice in your trial.
Thank you. That's very kind of it, and a pleasure to talk to your listeners.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Tony.
BCFM.
And that was Michael Shrimpton speaking to me earlier this week about his trial next week.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Joining me now is, from Friends of the Earth is David Powell. Hi, David. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
Flooding, how the floodwaters are actually subsiding. I was down there last weekend. I could see them going, well, not actually zooming down, but you can see how it's receded. There's a lot of debris being left. What's happening?
Yeah, I've just come back the other way, actually. I've been in London, and I've come on the train back through the other part of the country that's been affected over, you know, Thames Valley. It's been a week without rain, and the floodwaters are still there, so I think that tells you something about it. I think we learned a few things, haven't we? I think we've learned that we're not prepared for weather like that. You know, there is only a limited amount you could do when twice your normal rainfall falls. But I think we've learned an awful lot about that. We've learned that the government made some bad choices. We've learned what happens when you lay staff off. We've learned what happens when you cut funding for flood defences.
Well, another thing we've learned is that Chris Smith doesn't keep his promises. It was great to see the BBC rerunning the interview they did with him back last year, where he promised that they were going to dredge the Somerset levels, and of course it never happened.
Yeah, we've learned a few things about dredging as well, I think. We've learned that that's the thing that people want to happen.
The basic thing is, I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but is that these aren't natural rivers. Rivers will not silt up in the same sort of way. Is if us human beings start digging, and monks from Glastonbury Abbey start digging rivers, then nature will silt them up, and there needs to be some sort of action to stop that happening.
But I suppose the whole thing we've got to bear in mind, the whole of that area is not a natural area in that sense. We drained it. Somerset levels were drained. Over in Holland, they've had the same situation 40 or 50 years ago. Holland decided to get serious about flooding. You know, so much of their country is on the ground. They took very, very big decisions, spent an awful lot of money, and seriously relocated their rivers. Now, that's the sort of big decision that this country doesn't take, but it's the sort of thing we're going to have to get real about if flooding continues. And flooding will continue. Now, I know it's not a huge amount of comfort for the people down in Somerset who probably don't want to hear this, but the science is clear. This is what you get with climate change. Four of the five wettest winters on record have been this century, so since the year 2000, and the government is not serious about that either.
What would Friends of the Earth like to see the government do? Because when we heard that David Cameron was going to be some sort of super green, has he been backtracking?
If indeed he ever four-tracked. So the budget is next week. George Osborne said some fine things about climate change over the last couple of weeks. Let's see if he's serious about it. Flood defences have been cut in real terms. Never mind the fact they need to be increased as climate change gets worse. So let's have flood defence spending increased, and let's do all we can to solve the international problem of climate change.
Martin, what about the infrastructure value of this? Because surely this is actually something that's quite good. Generally, it actually creates employment and it helps get the economy going.
Well, as long as the infrastructure is well conceived, that's true. But if it's misconceived, then it's a waste of money, isn't it? I mean, spending money on infrastructure, I'm a Keynesian, I believe in building infrastructure, but you've got to build the right infrastructure. If you build the wrong infrastructure, you're just throwing money down the drain. What's the point of that?
David, the badgers, what have we learned from these badger culls other than that they were a failure?
So there's a theme here, isn't there? There's a theme of what happens when the government does policy based on short-termist things it's been asked to do, being seen to be doing something. There's a great load of connections with the flooding on this. So they were heavily lobbied by the farmers to do this. They wanted to be seen to do something, so they set these trial culls in motion. The Labour government spent, as I understand it, £50 million and 10 years studying whether badger culls work, and they concluded that they don't really, unless you go and you kill just about every badger in the area. What we've learned is that it's very, very expensive to kill a badger. It costs £4,000 to the taxpayer per badger that actually got killed. We learned that if you take a pot shot at a badger with a gun, there's quite a high chance of leaving it writhing around in agony. And, you know, one of the things that people really cared about was how humane is this? Not at all. And we've learned, again, of the dangers of sticking plaster politics, you know. If you have a problem with bovine TB, there are any number of causes for that. The fact that we ship animals around in poor conditions, terrible biosecurity at the cattle markets. But what we reach for is the thing that looks easy and gets the pressure off the government's back. It's the same with flooding. It's the same with farming. It's the same with the assault on, quote, green crap that we've heard from this government. You do something to make it look like you're doing something, but you're merely papering over the cracks and not addressing the big picture.
Okay, what's happening down at Hinckley anyway? I know there's something going on this weekend, I think. Some witches staying out overnight just to, I suppose, put some kind of curse on the place. But ultimately, is this going to happen? What's the latest on that?
So I think the latest of the Hinckley thing is it will probably go ahead. An interesting thing I've been reading about this week is this all depends on finding somewhere to put the waste. So we'll only get the go-ahead. I mean, Brussels is very concerned about the Hinckley deal anyway. Actually, having said it will go ahead, there's a lot of stuff that Europe's looking at.
That's right. Legally, they might just try and stop it.
Yeah, legally, they might try and stop it. But we've got to find somewhere to put the waste. That's the deal. And no one wants waste in their backyard. Up in Cumbria, they don't want it. I don't think anyone around here would want it. And if we can't find a sustainable thing to do with the waste, then the whole deal could be off.
Okay, David Powell from Friends of the Earth. If you could just maybe tell us how people can contact Friends of the Earth, join Friends of the Earth. How much does it cost, for example?
Well, you don't join Friends of the Earth. You support Friends of the Earth in a multitude of ways, financially as much as you like, as little as you like. You can take actions with us. Two ways: you can call our number 0207 490 1555, or go to the website, just search for Friends of the Earth, you'll find us.
If people aren't on the internet, give them a call. Just give that number again.
That's 0207, it's the London head office, 0207 490 1555.
David Powell from Bristol Friends of the Earth. No, Friends of the Earth nationally. In fact, what are you? You're an economics campaigner, is that right?
Yeah, so I do my work on economics and finance nationally. I happen to have the pleasure of doing it out of this fine city, though.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show again.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Martin, can't leave this week. I mean, we've got a couple of things we haven't been able to do this week. One is looking at the First World War, and the other is the Occupy. We'll do that next week. But with the disappearing 777 this last Saturday evening, Malaysia took off from Kuala Lumpur, full of passengers, mostly Chinese, heading for Beijing, disappeared completely off the radar. Hundreds and hundreds of distraught families still at Beijing, mostly some at Kuala Lumpur, waiting to hear what's happened to their loved ones. The most extraordinary piece of news came out this week from our very own Rolls-Royce, in fact, that the engines had been running for 4 hours after we were told that the plane had disappeared. And in fact, we're now getting a lot more information suggesting that the aircraft did, as was initially thought, make an about turn and was actually heading north when it actually disappeared off the radar, because it had gone down to a much lower altitude. So this is starting to look a little bit like I'm reminded of Barry Manilow and his Bermuda Triangle, because that was a song which was written about something which was a cover story to cover up a lot of dodgy activity to do with drugs. What about this one? I mean, this time it is possible, surely, that this aircraft actually landed somewhere and we just haven't been told where.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a developing story. It's very hard to unpick it. And, you know, as time goes on, we're finding out more and more about what's going on. I think that if you think back to the Korean airliner which overflew the Sakhalin Peninsula in the 1980s and got shot down by the Russians with all people on board killed, and it subsequently came to light that R.W. Johnson at Oxford University wrote a book about it, that in actual fact it was a deliberate provocation by the West of the Russian air defences. So we know about the Lockerbie bombing and who, you know, there's some new information coming out about that.
Is there any motive? Yeah, so is there any motive for a provocation against the Malaysians or the Chinese?
Well, I don't know. You see, this is.
I mean, there is this tension, of course, going on at the United Nations Security Council.
Exactly. I mean, there may be some political reason behind all of this. There may be just an accident, or another possibility I've been reading about on the internet is a plane disappeared in similar circumstances in the 1970s. It turned out it had been stolen for parts, like a car. So there's all sorts of theories out there.
I mean, just last year...
And obviously
year,
the real problem is that the families of the people concerned are obviously extremely upset.
I mean, just but last year, there was a fascinating story in Computer World on April the 11th, 2013, the headline, Vulnerabilities in Aircraft Systems Allow Remote Airplane Hijacking. I mean, we've had an article in the Daily Mail this week suggesting that the aircraft was hijacked. What the Daily Mail haven't considered is the possibility that it was hijacked remotely.
Well, exactly. On 9/11, planes did not fly directly to their targets. In fact, they flew very bizarre flight plans inside US airspace, and the best thinking on that, into my mind, is that they were actually flown remotely from the ground by something called Global Hawk, which people can look up by doing an internet search. Global Hawk first flew an aeroplane across the Pacific without a pilot in the 1970s, and if you think about modern technology, it's quite possible to take over a plane and fly it from the ground, especially if you're an intelligence service or a government.
Within the radius of the possible places that this aircraft could have landed are Okinawa, Guam, Darwin, which is a US base in the north of a military base in the north of Australia, and Diego Garcia.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, we're still trying to find means, motive, and opportunity if this is a criminal act. There's lots of tension in the world, and there's possible, you know, people could be manipulating these tensions, or we could simply be dealing with an accident. We shouldn't be jumping to conclusions.
Okay, time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 coming up. Thanks to the guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Eastern, Afzal Shah. Thanks also to David Powell there. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Decide to get away and have some fun. Book a room and catch a flight for 2 weeks in the sun. She says Hawaii's too expensive. I say Barbados isn't bad. She says I'd love to see Bermuda.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, 6 hours of talks between Russian and American foreign ministers over the crisis in Ukraine have ended without any agreement. Russia's Sergei Lavrov says there's no single vision. America believes Sunday's referendum over the Crimea region of Ukraine joining Russia is illegal. US Secretary of State John Kerry says it wasn't for the lack of trying.
I presented a number of ideas. However, after much discussion, the foreign minister made it clear that President Putin is not prepared to make any decision regarding Ukraine until after the referendum on Sunday.
The Conservative peer, whose helicopter crashed in Norfolk last night, killing all four people on board, had previously launched legal action against the company which makes it. Lord Ballyedman, who died in the accident in thick fog, reportedly raised concerns about in-flight mapping.